Last Week in Brexit is brought to you by Pearson Solicitors and Financial Advisors, helping businesses and families for over 100 years. And Greater Manchester Chambers of Commerce. Connect, communicate, create. Hello, and welcome to Last Week in Brexit, the podcast for Remainers and Brexiteers alike. Join me, Jonathan Beardmore, every week alongside Alex Davis and Christian Spence as we try and guide you through the choppy waters of Brexit. We're here once again in the rather friendly surroundings of Greater Manchester Chamber of Commerce Member Lounge. People, as usual, are busy discussing the heartbeat of Greater Manchester's business.
Absolutely, it all happens here.
Talking of all happening, we've got four position papers to go over. What's the other one? It's a future relationship paper.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
So before we get into any of that, thank you, of course, for supporting us either on iTunes or following us on Twitter. Please keep those reviews coming in. They are very, very important. Before we get into the really nitty-gritty of the position papers, why don't we talk about some other issues which have cropped up this week, namely these... are they reports coming out of the government, or are they independent regarding trade?
The trade papers that have been in the headlines, there's been two. So there was one, I think, on Friday last week, which came from the Institute of Economic Affairs. And then there was a follow-up paper. It wasn't actually a paper, the second one, because the paper is yet to be released, but we had kind of an introduction in the broad headlines from it, which came from a group called Economists for Free Trade, previously known as Economists for Brexit.
So are these guys neutral?
No. But both the papers basically focus on the idea of what they call unilateral free trade, which is essentially us not bothering with trade agreements and instead just reducing all of our tariffs on imports to zero. And the argument that they make is that this is the best way for us to essentially look after the economy and kind of get out there and start trading with the world post-Brexit. But both of the papers are essentially based on very traditional libertarian-leaning kind of economic theory around free trade and tariffs, and really kind of don't match up with the reality of modern trade.
Now, can I just clarify this for the listeners? When you say don't match up with the realities of modern trade, that's because the notion of tariffs is almost kind of redundant now in some circles, because they think the more important restriction to trade are regulations rather than out-and-out tariffs.
I think maybe these two papers coming out have made me rethink slightly the wording that I would use here, because I've in the past may have said that tariffs are largely irrelevant, but they're not irrelevant. It's just that there are substantially more gains to be made through other measures like regulatory harmonisation and things like that. So some tariffs exist for very, very good reasons. They exist to look after industries in particular countries. They may exist as part of wider trade agreements where other barriers, non-tariff barriers, have been brought down. So tariffs are, I would say, are shrinking in terms of their importance. But what these papers miss is the whole other aspect of it, which is the non-tariff barrier side of things. Mm-hmm. So the problem of regulations, standards, border checks, all these kind of things. These are the things which make up most of what modern trade deals are all about. And there are a number of just outright errors in both of the papers, particularly around things like what most favoured nation status means in the WTO.
Well, why don't you tell us, what does most favoured nation status mean?
In a nutshell, it's very badly named, first of all. In a nutshell, what it means is that under WTO rules, you are not allowed to give a tariff concession or a discriminatory tariff to one country. So, for example, if we leave the EU with no trade deal and then we want to reduce the tariff that we trade with the EU with down to zero, we also have to reduce that tariff down to zero for everybody else. What it also means for the EU is that if they wanted to trade with us on a zero tariff basis, technically they would also have to drop their common external tariff down to zero for everybody else. This only applies, though, outside of a free trade agreement. So free trade agreements can kind of supersede this arrangement.
Right.
But both of the papers make kind of pretty easy errors around this area, suggesting that essentially if we do leave without a deal, it will be very, very easy for both sides to continue to trade on basically the same basis that they do now. But in reality, things really, really aren't that simple. And, you know, the policy of what they call unilateral free trade would have significant implications for particular sectors of our economy, like manufacturing and agriculture, for example, which in particular the Economist of Free Trade paper, which is written by a guy called Patrick Minford primarily, in his earlier works it's an accepted conclusion that some of our industries will be absolutely decimated by this policy. So it's really it's a kind of thought which we have seen before, and generally what tends to happen is papers putting this kind of message come out and are routinely torn apart by all kinds of analysts and economists, and then, you know, it tends to go quiet, and then 6 months later we see a new one which is putting out essentially the same message. And I think it's particularly dangerous because the media tends to report on this stuff without a great deal of scrutiny, whereby if you follow the right people on Twitter, people who understand how trade works, you know, they'll tell you that this stuff is really, really dangerous and shouldn't be taken seriously.
So, Christian, do you disagree with the stance of Mr. Milford that we'll be multiple times richer once we leave the EU?
Yeah, broadly, yes, is kind of the short answer to that. But it's all about how it works. So this concept of declaring unilateral free trade kind of goes back to some of the, you know, the basic lessons the developed world learnt about trade economics in the 18th and 19th century, and, you know, the father of all this kind of trade economics is a chap called Ricardo. And one of that big lessons is essentially you want the countries who can produce the highest quality products the best to be the ones who win out. And that kind of comes down to a really fundamental concept in economics where, whilst there are producers, there's agriculture, manufacturers, the only purpose of producing anything is for a consumer to at the end of the chain consume it.
Yeah.
So the usual rule in economics is you must look at the world through the consumer's eyes. It's always about their ability to purchase best value product. Don't forget, trade quality and price have a trade-off, so we talk about best value. So in many ways, and in pure theoretical terms, the concept of lowering your external tariffs to zero is potentially really good news for your consumers, because yes, but there are external tariffs which we use now through the EU framework, which will be placing 10, 20 and upwards kind of tariffs on goods which are imported into the UK. Clearly, if those tariffs weren't there and we imported from different countries without them, then consumers could buy those goods for less money. Consumer wins, what's not to like? The big challenge, of course, is how do other countries do it more cheaply than us? And what impact might that have on the UK industries or the EU industries really within the EU that currently do that? So it might be that you can get your widget made much more cheaply in China whilst they're exploiting slave labour, whilst they're not paying staff properly, very low environmental concerns on generation electricity and manufacture the product, all of that kind of stuff. So of course they can undercut a Western firm that, as it were, is doing all of those things by modern Western standards. And so to try and level that market, that's one of the reasons tariffs can be used. So to price in what we call externalities. There's a concept that the production of that good somewhere else actually has causes damage or problems for other people, and that's not reflecting the price. So you use tariffs to try and level all of that market out. It's also used, as Alex said, for kind of protection of homegrown industries. So actually we want to look after and nurture, I'm trying to give an example, you know, new offshore wind farming in the EU, big industry for us. Other countries are starting to enter that market. They can do it for 10% cheaper, so if we slap on a 20% tariff, that means we're still competitive.
Yeah.
But of course, if you open all of these industries up to full global unilateral free trade, what you potentially do is completely eradicate them. So if we were to open up, if we were to go for zero agricultural, that's an easy one, food imports, what you would essentially do is wipe out UK farming, because there is no way that a massive developed nation with all of the additional costs the developed nation has can compete with sub-Saharan Africa, South America, Southeast Asia.
Isn't the obvious argument here that, of course, China or whoever it is going to use slave labour or lack environmental concerns, or, for instance, the sub-Saharan African countries are going to be able to outcompete us, because they're not exposed to these to our developed markets. And once they are exposed to our developed markets, and surely standards across the board will start to even out as in a burgeoning middle class, so on and so forth.
Exactly, and you're absolutely right. And that is essentially what bodies like the WTO and the big regulatory bodies of the world, which is primarily the USA and the EU, are working to achieve.
I mean,
this is a long, long... Again, this comes back to a lot of the stuff we talked about with the Brexit debate previously. This is a long, slow transition. What is really hard is to make a step change in that.
Yeah.
Because actually, yes, you do want to encourage China in, you do want to encourage developed nations in. There's already a policy through the WTO of which the EU is engaged, whose name escapes it. It's essentially least developed nation concept. So tariffs have been lowered for food producers in sub-Saharan Africa, particularly to get things like coffee beans in at lower rates, because that helps their own local economy. Them being stronger gives us a market to sell more developed goods back to. Everyone over time wins.
Yeah.
But to make a simple switch in that in one go would have huge ramifications. And, you know, what I don't know, I've not read the paper in detail from Minford, but is he costing in the additional economic development funding, the additional benefit funding that the UK would require as, you know, towns... Essentially, it's almost like the, you know, what happened in the big deindustrialisation of the northern towns in the 70s and 80s. You turn off the one industry on which they're reliant. Congratulations, you have saved the subsidy to the National Coal Board, which you were spending in the 70s. What you've now created is a 30-year welfare dependency.
Yeah.
That's much more expensive. Than the it's not the subsidy shouldn't come away and you shouldn't move it, but it's got to be a managed transition process.
Well, just staying on that note, one of the issues with the Minford paper is that we don't have the paper yet. We've actually only just got an introduction, really, and like the broad headlines. So the, I think, $135 billion number that apparently the economy is going to be better off by, we don't actually have the...
Is that per year? Is that like 10 years?
The calculations or the exact model that sits behind that, but it's going to be based on the same model which Minford has used before, which I think is called the Liverpool model, and again has been routinely torn apart by all sorts of people every other time that he's used it. All the things that Christian was mentioning are totally right, and it's kind of another aspect of trade agreements which potentially people like us don't talk of enough, is that trade agreements nowadays are big strategic undertakings, and it's not just tariffs or non-tariff barriers or getting goods across borders. There are geopolitical and security and human rights issues all woven into them, and this is why they're so complicated and they say take so long to develop, and you get something like the IEA or the Minford paper, which is based on basically pure economics out of a textbook that just doesn't take into account any of these things. And so there are a whole number of just real kind of errors and oversights that are made in the Minford paper, for example. He believes that price is essentially the only thing that matters when buying a good. So quality doesn't come into it, for example, or you might not want to buy something from a certain company because of their ethics or something like that. He takes no account of anything like that. He takes no account of what we call the gravity model in economics, which is that countries will tend to trade with the countries close to them rather than the countries that are on the other side of the world. He assumes it's just as easy for us to trade with Australia as it is for us to trade with Germany, which is demonstrably not the case. We have data which can prove it. The Minford paper too, his last paper anyway, where we can see the model, takes account of the fall of the pound and how it impacts on boosting our exports, but doesn't take into account the import side of things, so it will also raise import prices for our producers. It's just basically... It's all stemming from theory, and there are all sorts of ways in which it comes at odds with reality, and these things just aren't taken into account.
And it is hard. We see lots of commentators doing this around trade. And I mean, the other thing with, you know, both the IEA paper and the Minford one is there isn't a trade economist on any of the boards.
They're all macro economists.
They're all macro or monetary. So there's no trade economist. So the big challenge here is, of course, it's in the stuff we talked about in those very early podcasts. The UK hasn't done trade for 40 years since it joined the EU. The way trade is done globally has changed immeasurably over that period, and really rapidly, really recently. So whilst, you know, the UK is a founding member of GATT, General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, which came out in the 70s, that organisation essentially became the WTO in the 1990s. But since then, and since 2000 particularly, there have been a number of rounds of discussion from the WTO about essentially easing trade facilitation, making trade between countries and globally generally much more successful, much cheaper and much easier. And that's been through colossal regulatory alignment, and you know, Alex has talked in detail before about the, you know, the big global bodies who are driving regulation, and the EU, certainly the EU is one of those, but it also is taking instruction from bodies higher up the chain. We're seeing generally agreements on tariffs being lowered constantly across the world. I think, well, the average tariff globally now is about 3%. So I said there are sectors where they matter a lot. Mostly they don't matter that much. Now, certainly some of the guys at the IEA will push back and say, well, look, which is it that matters to you? Because you're telling me that tariffs don't matter very much and that unilateral trade is insane. Where do you strike the balance? And of course, the point is there are sectors where tariffs are still a very big issue. There are sectors where regulatory alignment is still a very big issue, and those would be you know, would be significantly impacted.
Okay, well, I think we've covered a paper which isn't out yet.
Yep.
Let's go over to these position papers. So, I think what we'll do is we will talk about the judicial dispute stuff.
Yeah, that's the latest one.
Yeah, because that is the relationship, future relationship paper.
Exactly.
Then we can sort of kind of lump customs, Northern Ireland and goods into the next bit.
Sure, okay.
So, go on then, who wants to lead off with this?
Go on, Alex, you want to kick off? And
well, we were told a few weeks ago that we were going to be getting 12 position papers over the next few months. So we saw the two big first ones last week, which were on future customs arrangements in the Irish border. And then we've seen three smaller ones since then. Mm-hmm. One which was on goods...
Already in the market at the point of Brexit. That's
yes, that so goods already circulating in the single market before the point of Brexit, and what happens regarding those. And then we've had two on kind of the legal side of things, which I really struggle with. So one was on...
confidentiality of documents between the UK, between the UK and the EU during our membership period, and what happens with those afterwards.
And then there was another one which we've had today, which was on dispute settlement, essentially, and that is the one that has been termed a future relationship paper rather than a position paper. And I think, of all of them, the one which came out today on dispute settlement and the future of kind of judicial oversight in that regard has been received quite well. But the fact that it's called a future relationship paper is quite telling, because really all it does is lays out all of the options available to us and gives no real detail as to which one we might want to go for. But there are lots of encouraging things in there. Loads and loads of mentions of EFTA and the use of the EFTA court to get around the whole ECJ red line. And really just loads and loads of options put on the table, all of which sound kind of reasonable.
It's the best paper we've seen, I think, in terms of a genuine pragmatic positioning from government.
Even though it doesn't actually give us a roadmap of where we want to go, it's just a collection of options.
It's a collection of options, and that's kind of... We'll just dwell on this just for a few seconds. Please. It's kind of something we've seen in common with all of the UK's papers since we started, is if you... And I encourage listeners to go and do this, and we're going to compile them all, actually, on the Last Week in Brexit website shortly. All the position papers that the EU have released so far, and all the ones the UK government have seen so far. And the EU ones are... I mean, they're utter models of legal clarity. In terms of what we want is A, B, C, D, E. We will not accept, you know, P, Q, J, all the rest of it. All the ones the UK government have put out have been kind of, well, there are a number of things we could look at, and there are some of these things we might want to consider. And there's no point at which the UK government takes a clear stance on what it wants. It takes a clear stance on the high level stuff. So, you know, we'll come to the Northern Ireland stuff later, but as an example, we want an absolutely frictionless border between Ireland. That firm statement. How you achieve that? No detail.
Yeah.
This one we want red line. The red line is we must be outside of jurisdiction of the European Court of Justice. How you do that? Well, there's a sort of a few different things, which I guess is going to, for me, I would say, is going to make the negotiations a little bit harder on our part, because we've kind of allowed ourselves to be fairly washy already, going up against a very big organisation that's bound by its own treaties. Will have less flexibility. That has been crystal clear about what it wants to see. Not all that's going to, you know, notwithstanding, it's a good paper that's pragmatic, and it shows, I think, that government is softening its position over the past few months.
Can I just go on a tangent there between, on the statement you made about the UK not knowing what it wants and the EU drawing some quite clear guidelines as to what it wants. We went to round three of the talks, and if the EU decide to allow for trade talks to happen in parallel to everything else, is that a sign that the UK strategy is actually working? Because I wouldn't say there's been sufficient progress on anything yet in order to allow trade talks.
No, and I think my opinion will be the same. And we know categorically from the European Commissioner, Michel Barnier, that is their position too. There has not been anywhere near enough progress. They set out right at the beginning that for them there were three things to be handled first: citizens' rights, Northern Ireland border, and financial settlement. Only when sufficient progress, that's the phrase, sufficient progress has been made.
It originally was, once they're settled, we will talk about it. And then it's changed.
Sufficient progress is where they're happy. So people talk about, we've got to come to the bill. We don't. The EU's not asking for a number. It's asking for an agreement on the model by which the bill will be calculated.
Yeah.
We said, you know, if you remember, David Davis said that he was going to have the row of the summer over that, because he wanted trade talks to run in parallel. He rode back on that in day one of the first round of negotiations. So both the UK and the EU have essentially agreed to this ordering of negotiations, which is kind of odd when we're now publishing, the UK government is now flooding the market with position papers for phase two, but actually we've still not seen the UK's position papers ironing out everything that needs to happen in phase one. And there's kind of messaging from the government that almost it hopes that by talking about phase two, somehow the EU might change its mind, but it seems unlikely, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, my view on this is there's clearly softening on both sides. And
I wouldn't say there's much softening from the EU side.
Would you not?
I think that, you know, that this was a very early shift when they said sufficient progress on the first round. There's not really been any shift since then. You know, they're holding. And the other thing as well is, don't forget, there's much less flexibility for Michel Barnier and his team than there is for our government.
So ask for permission.
Exactly, because it's our government doing the negotiations on our side. Obviously, government can define its own position. Michel Barnier is under strict instructions and signed off red lines from both the European Council and the European Parliament. So if he wants to move outside of those red lines, he's going to have to go back to those two bodies for approval. So,
or he's got to get creative with the language to make sure it fits within his red lines.
Exactly.
Which is kind of where I think that this will go. But okay, so let's just move over to these position papers. Now, I'm going to pull back the curtain a little bit here and tell you, we did talk about this last week, but because for many technical reasons I didn't record this properly, we have to do it again. So probably the most important and most substantial of the position papers was the Northern Ireland border paper. I think the best way to approach this is first just set out what Ireland's stance is and the current agreement between Northern Ireland and Ireland.
Okay, so I guess two major things, I guess, probably to dwell on, because there are two big treaties that cover what happens there. Number one is what's called the Common Travel Area. That's an old treaty that dates back, I think, to the 40s or 50s after the establishment of Ireland as a republic. It essentially allows for... it's a treaty between the Republic of Ireland and the United Kingdom, and it essentially allows for completely free, passportless, borderless travel for both Republic of Ireland citizens and United Kingdom citizens between the two countries, the two states. If you want to hop on the ferry and go over to Dublin, you can do that. You don't need to take a passport. The ferry company might demand one for identification purposes, but there's no legal border between those two. And that's exactly... reciprocal agreements are exactly the same for Irish citizens coming to the UK. The second one, of course, is in the 1970s. Both UK and the Republic of Ireland became members of the European Community and have advanced at identical stages throughout all of the treaties as they've been updated since then to today. So we're both members of the European Union. We're both members of everything that now encompasses, the single market particularly, common commercial policy, customs union, and a variety of other things. Crucially, we are both not signatories to Schengen. It is now rolled up within the EU treaties, but Schengen is the treaty which enables passportless checks within the European Union itself. So if you're travelling from France to Germany, there is no passport check. Of course, we all know when we go on holiday, we are passport checked. That's not an EU issue, that's an us. We're not part of Schengen. Ireland wanted to sign to Schengen, but essentially found that there is a big conflict between Schengen and the common travel area. How do you handle the issue of people moving across the Northern Ireland border if they say, we're happy to not have transport checks, but the UK is? So we stayed in tandem on that. So essentially, UK and Republic of Ireland form like a little entity of its own outside Schengen, within the EU. So the big challenge now as we leave the European Union is, how do we maintain that open border?
Yeah.
Because essentially the UK extracts itself, so there becomes a hard border. The EU's external border will run along the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. That ordinarily should mean full-blown customs checks and everything that goes with a normal external border. It is the desire of the UK government, the Republic of Ireland government and the EU that that does not happen for, I guess, what are the relatively obvious issues that there are big political tensions over that border already.
So, I mean, this is just so immensely complicated, isn't it? Because there is not only is there no border at the moment, it is explicit the explicit position from Ireland that they want no form of, no cameras, no technology,
absolutely
nothing.
It is a completely open border.
Yeah, and that is not just for people, as we've spoken about, but also for trade.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, so it's people and goods. Yeah, and all of the, you know, all of the freedoms, as it were, within the, that are currently within the single market. That is a big, and it is yet to be seen whether it is even a possible task.
So I just can't see, I'm sure I'm not the only one, how this can proceed. Just say if nothing happens and we crash out of the EU on the supposed date that we're meant to crash out, what happens to that border?
Quite, exactly. Now, the EU said something in the last 24 hours about that, but Alex, is it worth just touching on the two major options? Because the UK government's paper on this gives us two main options about how it thinks it can how it thinks it can handle this.
Yes, there are two broad options given. One is heavily reliant upon technology, essentially, to track goods as they go across the border. So we've seen this at other borders where there are cameras and basically everything is just walked through but is automatically tracked.
So this would be in Norway that this happens, I believe. Is it Norway and Sweden or someone?
The border between Norway and Sweden happens like this because, of course, Norway is not a member of the customs union. The big thing that's always worth caveating that statement, because Norway is not a member of the EU, it's not in the customs union, but it is a participant in the single market for its membership of the EEA. So that allows lots of things to happen much more easily because the regulatory systems are aligned.
Yeah, so there's the one solution which is based on technology, but we've never seen that technology handle the type of stuff which goes across that particular border. So it's kind of unprecedented that that would be a solution.
What's this type of stuff? Do you mean stuff or volume?
I mean volume.
Yeah, okay.
Volume and frequency. Yeah, I mean, the big thing is because it's an integrated market, goods in the same supply chain routinely cross that. You know, the usual example is go and talk to the Guinness factory and they will say Guinness being manufactured crosses that border four times.
Plus the process staff of being and all the rest of it.
Yeah,
the other big issue with the technology based solution is that all that infrastructure would need to be built, and we are currently not building it, and it would be an enormous undertaking costing a lot of money. And another interesting tidbit which I discovered was that under EU law all of the infrastructure would have to be on the Irish side of the border, not ours.
For what reason?
Because it would be an external border of the EU.
And it's the EU's position that member states have to police their own external borders.
Member states police their own, but also, this is the EU. This is, it's not just a national, and this, I think this is where a lot of the slip-ups in this kind of conversation make. People say, it's not just a national border. It is a customs union border.
Mm. Yeah.
And that has a very, very different impact. So the border between the Republic of Ireland and Ireland, it would not be comparable to the border between America and Canada or America and Mexico or other kind of concepts there. There are other rules going on. There's a big NAFTA agreement, of course, which tries to facilitate some of those checks, not without stopping everything. You know, it doesn't manage on everything, but those help. That is not the case. It is a full-blown... It is the world's biggest customs union border.
Right. The politics behind this is even more complicated than the actual technicalities behind trade. But you could say, well, maybe Northern Ireland will do some sort of deal with the Republic of Ireland to make it sort of a separate entity, but then people have literally died to make sure that that does not happen.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And this is where this would be difficult in non-politically tensious areas. In Northern Ireland, I've said this before, and it sounds very blasé. I don't think it was the case. This kind of issue has caused civil war before.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, it is of that sort of magnitude.
Yeah. So we're talking about the two options, and the second one is a bit more vague to me. It's based on some kind of waiver system, I believe.
Yeah, so the
idea... Is this the idea of the UK being an agent of the EU?
Well, that's kind of the first one, really, which is the technological one. So goods can come into Northern Ireland, and then the UK will put in place all of the EU's external tariff arrangements and customs arrangements on its behalf, but then track goods to their final destination.
Right.
And if they stay in the UK, then UK duties and UK VAT apply. If they don't and they go on into the EU, then they don't. Nothing like that has ever been attempted before, and it is seriously questionable whether you could ever do it. And the opportunities for evasion in all of that scheme are huge.
There are big problems overall. I mean, I think there are kind of philosophical almost issues with the whole approach that's being taken by these papers, because I mean the customs union paper and the Irish border paper, that you could have done them in one, because they're both so kind of codependent on one another, but the issue with both of them is that what we are asking for essentially is some new bespoke, massively expensive, you know, untested new kind of arrangement to come into place that affords us all of the benefits of the customs union and the single market without us being in either of them.
Sounds ideal.
Which first of all is something that the EU has said they won't allow. They've set out as an absolute red line. And then we're saying that we want there to be no border. Ireland wants there to be no border. The EU wants there to be no border. But we've heard from Brussels today that essentially what they've said is they don't see how that's possible. And I tend to agree that I don't see how it's possible, if we're outside the single market and the customs union, for there to be no border whatsoever. Another issue is that if we do manage to get one of these systems in place, it leaves us absolutely no wiggle room in terms of future divergence from the EU's regulations and systems, because we might be able to get a scenario in place where there is no border, but at the moment which we might want to change our tariffs or change our regulations or something like that, all of a sudden you've got the whole issue of a backdoor to the EU coming into play again.
Yeah.
And a backdoor to the EU is something which they absolutely will not allow, especially in terms of trade and people moving across borders.
This is completely hypothetical, not hypothetical, but it's almost impossible for you to answer. But do the EU value the integrity of the single market and the customs union more highly than they value the future of Ireland?
That's a horrible question. But it touches on something else I think was we were just chatting about earlier before this, is within the negotiation strategies, there's been lots of shouts about it's a negotiation, both sides have room to give, you know, EU will set out its red lines, we'll set out our red lines, those red lines will change to orange and yellow and be rubbed out and redrawn, you know, over the negotiation period. But I think there's an important bit that's missing here, or an important interpretation of that which is missing, which kind of hits on this point, and it's not the either or. The red lines we are currently drawing for essentially purely political, potentially economic reasons.
Yeah.
We've decided to set a red line that we must be outside ECJ jurisdiction and varying others. A lot of the EU red lines, particularly around things like single market participation, around external tariffs and customs unions, are part of at least their own internal treaties, but are also subject to international treaties and WTO jurisdiction. So there are some things which the EU are saying that they are its own red lines, which to be reasonable, it is not possible for them to move.
Yeah.
At least not without complete redrafting, not only of EU treaties, but with one eye to global regulation. So one of the things that came out, you know, when the EU published its customs paper and its Northern Ireland border paper together, trying to say, look, these two things are connected. We can't deal with Northern Ireland separately from dealing with customs because they're intertwined. One of the positions that's come back from the EU side is saying, well, look, actually, there is a real risk here. If the EU sets a precedent as part of its negotiation deal with the EU to exit, to treat one third country, the UK, differently in terms of land border access, A, it may well be in breach of WTO rules and the standards of global customs union, and it potentially opens itself up to trade dispute allegations from every other bordering country. Any deal for it on the Northern Ireland border has to be handled completely separately from the future relationship. because otherwise it potentially exposes itself into global law.
All right, so first of all, is there any obvious solution to this which is incredibly unpalatable to someone? So what I mean by that is something which we don't think will happen, but something which could actually solve it. For instance, Ireland also coming out of the EU might solve this, or Northern Ireland joining Ireland would solve this.
Both of those things would essentially solve that problem. It doesn't solve the UK island of Ireland problem, because you still have that sort of passage of trade, and don't forget over half of Ireland's trade is with the UK. So there are some big issues there. Both of those theoretically though would solve the border problem. Whether either of those are politically achievable
or
desirable or anything else. The other one, of course, is the good old EEAF line. And us taking that option would essentially, as we have said more times than I think I would care to remember, makes a lot of all this go away.
It seems to be a running theme in this podcast that we go down dead ends over and over again, only to find that the solution is EFTA.
Yeah, it is. It really is. I'm just going back to the position papers, I mean, I just want to stress the point that but neither of the papers give any real sense of gain from doing this. Essentially what's happening is we're squirming trying to figure out a way in which we can keep everything exactly the same as it is. But in doing so, we're also tying ourselves to the EU in such a way that we might not be able to do what we want in the future. And for me, it's the worst of both worlds, almost, the particular route that we're going down. I mean, we've said that the EA would solve it, but with the solutions that the government's currently proposing, we gain nothing, and we almost remove all possibility of us gaining something in the future. And so, of course, it goes back to the question why are we doing this? And neither of these papers kind of put forward any real reasons as to why we want to go down this route rather than remaining in the EEA. And the other kind of slightly, I don't know if it's dangerous, I don't know, maybe it is good game playing, is that some people have picked up on this in the sense that we've said, look, we want everything to stay exactly the same, and here are some proposed solutions in order to make that happen. And that now that puts the onus on the EU and Ireland, so that if this doesn't happen and things, you know, screw up, that it's not our fault.
Yeah.
And I just think that that's a bit of a dangerous way to think about this. But you could also say that it's potentially some way in which our government is trying to find a bit of leverage. And again,
I completely agree with that bit.
Yeah.
But the problem is, I think the worry for our point of view is it might be that in this area, and the EU's comment about if you're outside the single market and the customs union, it is a hard border. The point is the area we might be trying to find leverage in is one of the EU's immovable lines for all sorts of multilateral and international treaty rules. In which case, actually, if that's the case, it's potentially completely wasted effort.
Something's got to happen, because someone somewhere down the line has got to break a treaty or bend a rule or row back. And it seems like a very easy win for the government, this, because they simply do nothing and they win.
Well, potentially. I mean, but it's an incredibly high-risk strategy.
Yeah, but I mean, what is there anything else in the UK government's arsenal which is potentially as powerful as the Northern Ireland border? I don't think there is.
No, and in fact, actually, if we go back to the Lancaster House speech that Theresa May made in January this year, and her 12 points, I think we said almost immediately, point four, I think it is, which is protect the Northern Ireland Irish border, is the single hardest ask of everything we're trying to do. Primarily because we're saying we want to be outside the single market and outside the customs union. It's squaring those two things that is an unbelievably difficult and possibly impossible ask.
Well, we've got two sides with almost unlimited budgets, with almost unlimited access to brain power, so I'm going to be fascinated to see exactly how this one is rolled out. Northern Ireland border kind of links into the customs. What about goods in circulation? What is the current position with this?
Okay, do you want to, or shall I have a go?
You'll be best
at it. Apparently, we'll see. I'll see what I can do. So the issue here, of course, is what do we do? Because lots of people have talked about the it's easy for, winding back a bit, lots of people in the Brexit side have said, look, it's really easy for the UK EU to strike some kind of free trade deal, to have some kind of deal, because we have regulatory alignment. Of course, actually, we have 100% regulatory alignment. No two countries ever go into trying to crack a trade deal in that position. Isn't they're normally massively far apart. So therefore, it's really easy. And in many ways, it is. The challenge for the EU, who is the dominant partner and the regulatory setting body at all of this point, is what happens in the future. It's all right to say you'll be regulatory aligned at day one. What will that look like on day two? But never mind, 2, 5, 10, 20 years down the road. So the challenges for getting a good trade deal away will have to cover all of that stuff, and then we hit the ECJ red lines that we've set out and all of that kind of thing. So this was about, actually, what do we do about goods that are already on the market? So, you know, a manufacturer in the UK pops its good out of the production line on the day before we leave the EU, it then goes off into circulation.
Yeah.
What do we do about that? And the UK's position is that should still be perfectly valid for resale throughout the EU. It was made when we remember, it was made when we were regulatory compliant, therefore it must be regulatory compliant. End of story. That's position number one of the first stage. Second position is, what do you do about stuff that's pushed onto the single market after Brexit, but whose design essentially was signed off whilst we were still a member? So the great example, the biggest and easiest example here is cars being made by UK manufacturers. Nissan might be churning for 3, 4, 5 years after we leave cars into the marketplace that were designed, scrutinised and signed off to EU regs before we left. The UK's position, therefore, is therefore that's fine. Those should just be able to circulate because we kind of know they're still there. And then there's the third stage, of course, is what you do for certification of goods designed and produced after we leave into the EU afterwards. And the UK, the government's position then is there should be authorities in the UK who are codified to EU rules and they can check the standards. It's fine. All of the things I've said, of course, work both ways for EU manufacturers seeking access to the UK. I think where this is probably going to run into difficulties, we've proposed kind of either UK bodies or joint EU-UK bodies to oversee. This, I think, is where the EU will push back and say this has to be the ECJ, because the ECJ, European Court of Justice, is the court which rules over single market rules and regulations. No other body can ever be in a position to certify those. Now, I think that this is one of the areas I think where there'll probably be some room for manoeuvre. I think the first case of the UK government, so stuff that's actually been physically made beforehand, won't be a problem. I think the EU will slip that through without any problem. That'll probably have to be time limited, because you need to allow for the fact that EU regs will move on. So something which is compliant today might not be compliant in 3 years' time. So for things which might stay on the market for that kind of period, I think that might be that'd be an issue. But I think the EU will go through that. The second one, I think, is something the EU would probably be happy to concede on. So cars made in 2020 to 2018 designs and certs are fine. The third one, I can't see the EU standing. Essentially, this is the EU's treaty line. You know, the UK becomes a third country. It is outside of the rules and regulations. These things can be cracked with free trade deals. They can be cracked with mutual recognition agreements. They can be cracked with customs agreements. But all of those things would tie our regulatory bodies two aspects of the EU over the long term. That's not necessarily a bad thing, but it'll be a political tension for our government to work.
And don't forget AFTA, of course.
And of course AFTA. Yeah.
All right. So just quickly linking this back to one of the previous papers, is there anything in the future relationship paper, if I've got mm-hmm. that terminology right, which talks about the ECJ doing something like part regulation, maybe regulation over things which go into the single market?
Well, that's really the one that's come back today, Alex.
My honest answer is I haven't had enough time.
to unbelievable. Figure that out.
There are tons of options put forward in the paper, but it seems to be still a red line. I think Theresa May made a statement just recently that
that's right.
The Supreme Court will
will be the ultimate arbiter of UK UK law and dispute stuff. But I think there's two aspects of the paper we've seen today. So it deals with dispute resolution. So there will be an agreement of some sort, whether it's small, large, comprehensive or deep, between the UK and the EU after we leave. The UK government's position is there should be an independent body spun up to arbitrate over disputes between the UK and the EU in that scenario. I think that's perfectly reasonable. I think that's where we'll end up. The EU's starting negotiating position is that with the ECJ. I think it's perfectly reasonable to see that that becomes a bilateral body, which is essentially what you have between the EU and Canada in CETA, and it's what you have in most bilateral trade agreements. That, I think, that will be easily solved. The harder bit in that is about whether the ECJ can be removed from jurisdiction over current issues.
Well, for instance, we might not want to overseeing human rights, but actually single market, that's actually a fairly sensible thing for it to oversee.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's it. So I think there's, the commentary I've seen, as we've said, this paper's only been out, just under 4 hours at the time of recording. But from the quick analysis from the people who are in the know and tracking this of deeply, I think it's broadly welcomed as a pretty good paper. Mm-hmm. We've floated EFTA to be there's a concept of EFTA or an EFTA-like body being able to sit in that position. Getting into EFTA is not without its difficulties, but it at least already exists and treaties are already in place. The challenge will be, I think, the UK government also wants ECJ out on issues which are essentially of ECJ control. That is single market, some of the single market aspects, that is over things like human rights, which kind of get ruled through the ECHR and it's a separate body, but a lot of that stuff's kind of been subsumed into some of those structures over the years. I think that'll be harder for the UK government to pull off.
Now, this is more of a internal question rather than anything else. But now you've seen some of the position papers, and not just Greater Manchester Chamber, but chambers up and down the country. Will you guys be taking a position as to which way you want the government to go now? And when would you expect that that opinion to be formed?
It's a really good question. And I think you understand for delicate political reasons, it's something we've strayed away from, or at least we've actively taken the decision not to take that call yet.
Yeah.
The gut reaction is it's probably still a little bit early. We've been very clear on things like citizens' rights. That's one of the early stages, where for us it's actually, we say the EU position is broadly very sensible, just everything everyone has got now, lock that in place for those who are here, and then it shifts after that. Because it's just it's one of those things, in all of this debate, it's just get it out of the way. There are a number of things you might want to go to the wall to and fighting for. The Northern Ireland border issue is one. Long-term customs integration, how you do it. These are chunky. Citizens' rights stuff, it's just don't worry about it. It's inward and migration, and migration between the UK and the EU is going to continue in volume for a long time. Don't worry about it.
I might just add to finish off, whilst we're having discussions about whether we might come out at a later date with a more solid position, I think avid listeners of the podcast could probably figure out what it might be.
Yeah. That's exactly.
So go back and listen to a few other episodes if you're wondering what it might be.
Yeah, that's it. So I think it will come, actually. I cannot speak at all on behalf of other chambers across the network, nor of British chambers. They will form their own opinions in due course. But I think my gut reaction is if everything hits the timetables as it's meant to be, so we do actually get through these first three major issues by the autumn, so the October round starts to talk about trade, then I would have thought October, November, December, we're probably in a position where we start seriously shaping and trying to influence government in the direction it takes, and you'd potentially then be much more outspoken about you're trying to take path B, we actually think that is harmful and incorrect, and this is a better way of doing it.
Okay, and one last one, which is now you've finally seen some position papers and we're kind of getting a feel for what the UK government is wanting to do. Are you filled with more confidence, less confidence, or are you based exactly where you were before?
I'd say I'm probably about where I was before.
Yeah.
Because there are some aspects of it which potentially give me a little bit of hope, like all the mentions of EFTA and things like that. But then the customs paper and the Irish border paper potentially throw them in the other direction. Yeah, it's a difficulty just with the entire approach that we're taking to this thing, rather than any specific details.
No, I think that's a really good summary. For me, the same. My confidence level is low. It's definitely higher than it was, in the sense that particularly today's paper, actually, on jurisdiction, sends a message that government's internal position is changing pretty rapidly. I'm not yet sure it's changing substantively, but the Theresa May's speech this morning talking about direct jurisdiction, we know legally that means nothing, but there's a preparation for a change of tone going on in there. The concept of EFTA or independent court jurisdiction is an indication of softer tone. As Alex says, though, the customs and the NI ones are really hard, but that they are really hard subjects in an ideal world. They're unbelievably difficult in this one. I think still, whilst more comfortable, my gut reaction is still pretty low, in the sense there is a very, very long way to go for government to have clearly sent a message that it understands what it's going through and some of the issues. The whole transition stuff at the moment, we're not talking about a transition deal. What it appears they're talking about is how do we extend the precise status quo until we get to the point of talking about long-term stuff. That is not a transition arrangement. And it's a case of, we've told the public we're leaving in 2019. What we ideally like to do is boot that back to 2022, but we can't get away with it, so how do we kind of cover that gap? And that's not a mature approach to be taken.
Excellent, right. Well, let's leave today's podcast there. Before we go, anything happening exciting in the chamber this week?
I think this week, no. We're kind of a bit quieter with it being August. Not much external stuff. It's all eyes for our huge construction summit north on the 13th and 14th of September at University of Salford. That's where our focus is for now.
Excellent. We can find you boys on Twitter where?
I'm at @GMCC_Alex.
At @GMCC_Christian.
And I may as well throw my own in, which is at @JBeardmore. So, until next week, when we'll come back to you with even more high-quality Brexit chat, goodbye.